Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
It isn't in my blood. I know I could treat you better.
You know this is all on tape?
You know what? I don't think we have the rights to that. I think Shawn Mendes is licensing.
Fair use. Fair use. Nice try, though.
That was such an obvious. It wasn't even derivative. It was sounded exactly like him. So.
Oh, wait. Is this for real? Are we actually starting? There was no, like, go sign.
Uh-oh.
What is that? Holy cow.
And it's on.
Well, let's hope by now you know that I'm Kai Rizdahl, because, you know.
I'm Molly Wood, the one singing the pop songs when we're supposed to be doing the show.
Man, what? That was like producing by surprise. Ready, go!
It was. I think they're just trying to see what's going to happen. I think it's
Now we know.
New experiment. That's right. As soon as we hear the music, we're gonna lock it
stops.
Down.
We've run out of intro music.
Oh, my God. Do you think they're going to start over?
No, they're not. No, they're
Welcome.
Not. If you keep going, then they can't start over. Go. Come on. Next line is yours.
All right. Welcome to Make Me.
There you go.
Next line is yours. Hi, I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart, the podcast where we are joined, as always, by you and surprise producing.
Can I just say that none of the producers in the room on the other side of the glass are smiling? None of them.
Are they not smiling?
They're not
having fun at all?
I'm making them. Oh, man.
Oh, see, last week I got to see them.
Now I have to. So look, this week we're going to do something a little different. We're going to take you on a little journey, actually, into the saga of a somewhat bizarre spam email we got in our listener email box. And it goes to online dating and hacking, also Irish butter. It's kind of wild, actually, which is why we're going to run it.
It is wild. And the best part is that it ends up in a place that we have been talking about on the show for oh so long. It ends up with misinformation and propaganda and the tools of what our guest, Jonathan Morgan, who is a cybersecurity CEO, he is going to call cognitive hacking.
Yep.
And he and his team essentially went on this investigative rabbit hole for us, and now they're basically our resident bot hunters.
Yeah,
we're going to use them all the time.
We've got some.
It's a fascinating tale.
First, we got to do this.
All right, today we do have a news fix for you, a fixation fix, but it's it is being termed by our producers a skinny fix.
Who love us so much right now.
Which I think is a hint, and that hint is don't talk for that long.
Yes.
Please.
Yes, yes, yes.
And it's because of our big investigation in part two of
totally,
the show.
Totally. All right, so mine's super quick. I don't know what yours is, so you go first.
What?
I don't care.
It's a total mystery. You go first.
Okay, all right. I'll go first. It's super fast, and it comes with this anecdote. The Fortune 500 list came out yesterday. The biggest companies in this economy by revenue. Walmart's on top, yada, yada, blah, blah, blah. Here's what you need to know. Only 24 of those companies are run by women, which is terrible.
Ooh.
Simply terrible. But it gets me to this, which is actually kind of cool. On Friday, there's going to be a new CEO at the New York Stock Exchange, which I think is really cool because it's a woman for the first time ever.
Huh.
Her name is Stacey Cunningham, and she started at the NYSE in 1994 as an intern, and now she's running the place. And I just think that's cool. That's it. That's all I got.
All right.
Isn't that cool?
That's, that's like two steps back, one step forward.
Yeah,
I'm into it.
I didn't want to do trade or any of that, real economy stuff, but I thought that was a pretty interesting indicator. So Fortune 500, bad news, new female CEO at the NYSE, good news.
I will take it.
That's right.
Did you see that the New York Times started a roundup of good news?
Did they really?
Oh my God. To? Yeah.
That's
and
so
I,
funny.
They were like, you can subscribe to this. And I was like, yes, please. I subscribe
totally.
To that immediately. Just
totally.
Send me the good news. That's all I can take. However, that is not what I have for you today in my skinny fix. No.
Hollywood down on.
Here on our podcast, Take Me to the Dark Place.
Wow. Which is usually my job, by the by.
I know, yeah, but sometimes. No, I am going to raise a philosophical question in the form of an Amazon PR statement.
Okay.
So I saw a story that I actually seriously, sincerely believed was an Onion story this morning about Amazon's Recognition facial surveillance system. It is spelled with a K, and something about the vaguely Nazi-esque overtones of spelling it with a K is partly what made me think that it was an Onion story, but it's not. The ACLU of North America found details about this facial recognition surveillance system, which Amazon has apparently deployed under non-disclosure agreements in multiple cities like Orlando and then in Washington County in Oregon, and is using to do this real-time surveillance based on facial recognition. This obviously raised some privacy concerns. The ACLU is asking them to either shut it down or make all the details available. And this is the part that I would like you to ponder between this week and next. Amazon's statement in response to this uproar said, quote, "Our quality of life would be much worse today if we outlawed new technology because some people could choose to abuse the technology." And in light of all the things we've talked about on the show today, Facebook, or not today, in the past few months, the past few years, specifically around technology and the reckoning that we're having with technology, this is a sort of Amazon's way of saying, I don't know, just because like it's like the opposite of just because you can doesn't mean you should.
There you go.
Amazon is saying we should. Period. Full stop. Anyway, I found that to be a very thought-provoking statement that we will return to in a future episode.
Right. Well, so think about that for the next 48 hours because we're doing this one again in what, like 2-3 days? Because
yes,
this is a big week. This is a big week. We're going to do a second show on Thursday. It'll drop, I guess, on Friday. Right. Yes. And why, Mollywood?
Maybe Thursday drive time. I hope you have your cocktails at the ready. And the reason is because we are going to give you the show on Friday, which is GDPR Day, Europe's General Data Protection Regulation. Like, nobody's more stoked about this than you.
We should have had trumpets, man. Needed a fanfare.
GDPR Day! I just went straight to laser sounds.
Oh, my God.
So, interesting side note, apparently the GDPR has already essentially been in effect for almost a year. On Friday, May 25th, is when the enforcement can begin.
Is that the deal? That's so interesting. Uh-huh. So you learn something on this podcast every doggone day.
You kind of do. And that is probably a clarification I should have made sooner. But what makes it exciting is that I feel like Friday is when enforcement starts. Like Monday is when subpoenas go out. I can only imagine.
See, I think
they've just been like,
getting
them all ready.
I think that, I think that's a little wishful thinking. I'm not sure that's going to happen that fast.
I don't know. I mean, this is something that we in America are only just becoming aware of, relatively speaking.
Yep,
but
yep.
The GDPR was, I think, passed in 2016. Like, there is every reason to think that regulators have been compiling their dossiers, if you will. However, we'll see. It's also a big week because, as you know, Mark Zuckerberg is speaking before Parliament in the UK right now. I closed my Twitter tab because I don't want to get distracted.
Thank you.
But we will have a little bit of a recap of that because this privacy conversation, obviously, ongoing, bigger and bigger. And we're going to have a special episode that is going to involve some compliance lawyers and their punny drink names. That's right.
Wow.
Cocktail list.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You get all the fun, man.
I love our show.
The economy and stuff. Anyway.
You should make a drinking game out of one of your economy things, and then you too could get an awesome cocktail list.
Yes, I just need better things, you know?
One of your economy things, by the way, should be a t-shirt.
Yes, that is true.
For you.
That is true. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever. Let us know what you think about my economy things or what Molly gets excited about or, you know, take your pick. Email us. And I would actually say what it is, except I forget. What is it? MakeMeSmartAtMarketplace.org? Yes.
It Phew. Is.
Twitter is better, though. I know that one. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. She's at Molly Wood. And hit us up.
Your drink puns are always welcome. First, a little music and then our Butterbot investigation.
Okay, so we have, as many websites have, a form at makemesmart.org. It's where you can fill it out and give us your name and your email address and send us your thoughts and insights on what you hear and what you want to hear about.
That's right, and it's super useful. It is also, unfortunately, super useful for bots. The email bots that computer programmers build to spam your inbox with malicious advertising, which may or may not have come from the form, actually. It's probably because we have our email somewhere in clear text on the website. Nevertheless, anybody who runs a blog or a website or has email gets these emails that are spammy and have links in them. Our producers actually noticed one of them that, for whatever reason, caught, I think it was Chris Olin, caught his eye. It stuck out because it was different from all the rest.
It was literally just sentence fragments that seemed like they were lifted from ads, from Kerrygold, which is an Irish creamery that apparently makes butter wrapped in gold foil. I don't know about these things. Anyway, so we read part of that on the air because it sounded so completely ridiculous. And then we got an email from a listener named Stefan Spear, and he asked us to dig in deeper to what was going on.
Yes. And so we called up Jonathan Morgan, the CEO of New Knowledge, because that is exactly how this show is supposed to work. Knowledge is a company where you, like, we hear a funny thing and then you have a thought about it and then we get an expert. New Knowledge is based in Austin, Texas, and it is a company that combats disinformation campaigns and other types of social media manipulation. Steph Hughes, who is the producer of Marketplace Tech, my other show, found this guy for us and gave us this recommendation. And we were hoping that he would just tell us, you know, how the name Kerrygold and how this butter connection wound up in this spam message. And it turned out to be an amazing tale. So without any further ado, here it is.
What is the deal with this bot thing that we got?
Yeah, what's the bot for?
What's the bot? What's kind of fun about the bot that you all discovered, the one that had been sending messages to y'all through your web form, is that it's not a bot that's trying to email anybody. So you all received it through email after it came through your website, but it's a bot that is just running around the internet, filling out forms wherever it can find them. And the reason that it would do that is so that the content that it's generating, the messages that it's generating, will show up hopefully in places that are more public. So that way, when a search engine like Google or Bing or one of the other ones runs around trying to find and figure out what people are talking about or kind of indexing all of that language and making it possible for people to search for it, they'll find those comments on, you know, web forums or social media websites or whatever. So it's pretty much just a bot that knows how to spam whatever it can find, whatever websites will take that spam.
So we wanted to give you an idea of how weird this spam comes across when you read it, because it's kind of phenomenal, and how it can basically fool all the filters that are out there by, in essence, sounding vaguely close to human.
Yep. And so we asked Marketplace senior editor John Buckley, otherwise known as our favorite voice in the office, to be to reprise his role as Make Me Smart's voiceover emeritus and deliver a dramatic reenactment of what Kerrygold-inspired spam sounds like. So you're going to hear that, and then we're going to pick up the interview from there.
Kerrygold butter has a rich overall look that pastry's flakier while gravy's better. It also gets better our own presenting superiority with regard to baked products. Incredibly, pastries or crusts tend to less crumbly. Kerrygold salted, charming face cream butter is a premium butter released to superior conditions and thus has now received a major international good reputation caliber.
I love John Buckley so much. So first of all, so much for the fact that if you have an English accent, you sound smart all the time. But that was nonsense, right? So how does that translate into something worthwhile for whoever wrote this bot?
Well, I think the best part about this bot is that it's barely nonsense. You know what I mean? Like, you listen to it, especially hearing it read out loud by somebody who, you know, it sounds like, you know, John's an excellent ad reader. It gives it that air of legitimacy. And I think the reason that that happens is because the language is not ridiculous. It's kind of like a Mad Libs, but somebody filled in the wrong words in all the wrong places, if that makes sense. Like, syntactically, in terms of sentences, it, you know, kind of makes sense. But the reason that they – so what I think probably happened is that the spammer found a bunch of text that was readily available, and they cut that text up into a bunch of little pieces, and they fed it to an algorithm, so some type of, you know, some piece of software that understands how to put things back together again, but in a way that's not the same every time. So, you know, because if I'm, you know, if I'm Google or whatever and I have access to the entire internet, I would spot content that was repetitive. If I saw the same comment on 50 different websites, I might start to get the sense that it's probably spam. But what this technique allows the spammer to do is generate slightly different pieces of text. So it's on the same topic. And even though to a human being it looks ridiculous and it sounds a little bit ridiculous, like it's like a cultured dairy ad that went slightly awry. But it, that doesn't really matter because they're not trying to fool human beings. They're trying to fool other machines. So if they can fool the other machines, then they can achieve their goal, which is ultimately to get that text that they've created indexed by the search engines so that, you know, whatever else they're hiding in there might rise to the top of search results, which might achieve some other objective. So it's kind of like they need to fool the machines first as part of a larger scheme, you know, to accomplish whatever it is that they're doing.
It's like Mission Impossible. Like first you got to get past the thumbprint reader and then you got to, I may or may not have been watching that last night. So, and then does it matter? I'm on target. Does it matter if the email makes its way to me or is it more about the indexing? Because there is a hyperlink. There is a link in the middle of this spam email.
Mm-hmm.
Do they want me to click it?
Well, I would argue that that's probably not the goal, just because the text is so ridiculous. Like, with a little bit more work, you can generate text that looks more plausibly sent by a human being. And if this were an email scam, then there'd be no harm in sending the same email to a large number of people and then masking that behavior in some other way. So what I think these folks were doing is actually putting that link in the body of the text that they were automatically generating to like cast a really wide net, to seed that content in as many places as possible so that when search engines see it, they go, oh, that link must be really important. It's showing up in a lot of places. And so then they follow that link, they scrape the contents of the page that that link refers to, and they go, whatever is happening on that page, a lot of people link to it, so it's probably important. So when people search for any of that text, we're going to show them this search result. And so they're basically just trying to push people to that page for whatever reason. And then and the reason that they're trying to push people to that specific page actually got really interesting when we dug into it a little bit. Like, this is a very elaborate a very elaborate little scam,
so
even though the text that they're generating is so naive.
Yes, please. Well, tell us more.
Okay. Well, so if you follow the rabbit hole a little bit, it turns out the link that's embedded in that text sends people to a site that is debating the legitimacy of another website. So, okay, there's the text, follow the link, get to a website. The website says, is Asia Me a legitimate website? And so we're like, what's Asia Me? I have no idea. I just followed the text from this spam link. But then you go to Asia Me, and it's a website geared, like targeted at Westerners who are looking for love amongst, like they're looking for an Asian partner. So Asia Me is a dating website where you know, sign up and presumably you meet Asian singles looking for love, and then things work out hopefully for the best. You know, you whatever you
what
you find love,
go
you
wrong?
What could possibly
wow.
go? I you know, it's almost like they're preying on people's emotional vulnerabilities in order to get something from them. I don't know.
Huh? Weird.
Right, but then if you go to the, I've never heard of that before. If you go to Asia Me, then it. I mean, it looks. It looks a little sketchy. And so what I think happened was that people went to Asia Me. They thought that it looked a little bit sketchy. And then they would go search on a search engine like Google or Bing or whatever and say, is Asia Me legitimate or is Asia Me a scam? And so the only way that these scammers or people, you know, whatever they're trying to get out of the Asia Me users, they had to figure out how to stop them from discovering that the site was a scam. And they knew that the first thing everybody would do was Google, is Asia Me a scam? And so they had to come up with a different website that would tell people, oh, no, it's not a scam. But then they had to figure out how to make sure that that result was the highest in the search engine rankings above all of the other content out there, because it was reported. Like, people knew that Asia Me was a scam. And so they had to kind of like fool the machines in order to fool the humans in order to then, you know, do whatever they do, extract money from them or something when they create a profile on the Asia Me website.
This seems like so much effort.
Mm-hmm. It does.
Like,
does
the Asia Me website really generate that much, whatever it is? Either, I mean, what do we think that website does? Like, extort people into paying for a service that's not real? Or, what could possibly be worth this amount of work, I guess?
I think you're absolutely right. So what we found was that Asia Me has been around for a little while, and it used to charge people $1,000 to create a profile on the site and then, you know, have some guarantee about the relationship success that you might have. And so I think that was the scam. So we created a fake profile to see if we might, you know, discover anything interesting about how the site works. And we've yet to receive any requests for relationships from Asian singles or anybody for that matter. So I think it's also possible, given the kind of site that it is and the kind of information that's normally revealed on dating websites, it could be used to extort people because they've posted embarrassing information. Maybe they thought that they were getting into a relationship, and so they made themselves vulnerable, shared whatever information about their lives or their past or photographs, and who knows how embarrassing that gets. So I think that's another possibility. At the moment, I think what likely happened was that they were charging users. People who were maybe a little bit naive to that process, didn't understand that they shouldn't be paying for that type of thing, paid their money, realized it was a scam. The internet started to figure out that it was a scam. And so they've launched this kind of additional whatever, you know, these new tactics to try and convince people that, no, it's not a scam because this website, you know, evaluated it for some reason and everybody says that it's legitimate, even though that's almost certainly not true.
All right. So can we back up for a minute to the part where you talked about computers trying to fool computers and people and because this is hacking, but not really, but kind of it's a little bit meta, you know?
It is a little bit meta. It's like it's kind of like cognitive hacking, if you know what I mean. Like
I don't know what you mean.
Well, like it has a lot of the same characteristics of hacking like we traditionally think about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a system, the system has vulnerabilities, and I can use automation to find those vulnerabilities. Because the way that the kind of the tricky thing about hacking is, or the reason that it's successful is because most people have pretty good defenses against somebody trying to like take their stuff or fool them or manipulate them in some way. And a bad hacker would push really hard at the thing that they wanted. But if you push really hard at something, you kind of expose yourself.
Right, you expose
the fact that you're trying to commit a crime or steal something or whatever. And so hackers that are good just poke a little bit in a lot of places. And it's really difficult to defend a lot of places really well. And so by poking a little bit, they don't reveal their activity and they're more likely to find the vulnerability. And then once they find the vulnerability, then they push hard. And so this is really similar, where they're writing software that basically tries to get their fraudulent content in front of as many people as humanly possible. Because if you cast a really wide net and you get in front of a lot of people, you're likely to find those who are less savvy about the type of content that they consume online. Or maybe they're really lonely. Maybe they're just really attracted. Whatever it is that makes them vulnerable, they'll be discovered if you cast a wide enough net. So they're pushing a little bit. Sure, it looks kind of fraudulent, but it's not that big of a deal. They're just link spamming, which is something that people used to do back in the 90s. Like, it's probably just, you know, generic kind of internet crap that nobody's really going to pay attention to. And then, but you find those few people who needed just a little bit more of a push to hand over their credit card or their personal details to this Asia Me website. And you find out where you can deploy your resources to push the hardest and get a return on that investment. So it's kind of inexpensive to do this type of like cognitive hacking. And then you can do the more expensive stuff, the kind of real detailed, deep manipulation of some individual once you've found somebody who's going to be a prime target for your kind of criminal activity.
So there was a lot in there, but that whole idea of cognitive hacking and the way we / the internet / machine / whatever are manipulated is kind of gobsmacking, frankly. Maybe I'm just naive.
It is gobsmacking. It's, yeah. And it's really, I mean, what I love about this is that we started with spam and are ending up with the way that information is manipulated online and how... I guess, relatively speaking, not hard it must be, you know, because if it's worth it, as we were saying, if it's worth it to
just
do it for this dating website, just for that, it's going to get it's going to get a little darker.
Yeah.
We have part three, 2.5 of the interview here because we have that little piece at the top. It's important to be precise. But we are going to ask Jonathan in the rest of this interview what the connection is between our Kerrygold bot and the way that hackers spread spread fake news across Facebook and Twitter. First, though, I feel certain that you have a hankering for butter. So go get yourself some toast. I don't know. It was a stretch. It was a stretch. I admit it. What I meant was, we'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. More with Jonathan Morgan about that whole Kerry Gold thing.
Yes. To recap, we have learned that our Kerrygold spam bot manipulates Google's algorithms in order to drive internet users to a website. Jonathan tells us that this strategy is also used to exploit social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook to get that website link in front of more eyeballs.
Many more eyeballs, it turns out. And it's not just...
Many more.
Yeah, and it's not just dating websites, right? I mean, this all goes to the whole fake news thing and social media and all of that. So we asked him if it ought to be harder for people to manipulate social media in order to promote things, given that those things can be really important. Hello, politics. Here is more from Jonathan Morgan.
What we've seen is that when you do raise the bar to something really valuable, like impacting the outcome of a major Western election, for example, people will work really hard at accomplishing it. And the really similar techniques, like in the example that we've been talking about, all the scammer needed to do was change people's belief, like change their perception about the legitimacy of something, in this case, a dating website. But what if it was changing people's perception or belief about the legitimacy of a publication posting political news? And so if you could convince everybody that some website was legitimate and authentic and you were controlling that website, well, then you could have it say whatever you wanted it to say in support of whatever candidate you wanted, in support of whatever issue you wanted, to really convince people that the reality that you want is already real. And I think that that's really powerful, especially when it comes to things like the way that we govern our society. So it's same techniques, same tactics. And I think what people have realized, these kind of large-scale cognitive hackers, you know, whether we're talking about domestic politics or whether we're talking about, you know, hostile foreign governments, whoever it is, they are kind of finding these vulnerabilities in our systems. And I think what most of these system designers have realized, the Facebooks and the Twitters and the Googles, is that they never anticipated this type of attack. And so now they're trying to figure out how they can plug these gaps, how they can sort of retrofit their systems or redesign them to be more robust against this type of hacking.
So as a professional in this field, let me ask you this question, though. How are they doing so far?
I think everybody I've spoken with at the different social media platforms now takes the problem very seriously. So, you know, they've taken a lot of hits in the press, and I think a lot of that was deserved. But that has had the effect that I think everybody wanted, that now it's seen as a very serious problem inside most of the major social media companies. And I think that they are working very quickly to try and solve the problem as best they can, but there are still really big gaps. And the gaps are that most of them don't understand how to observe these types of attacks as they move from one platform to another. Mm. That's a really big one. So like what we saw with this, you know, this weird kind of cultured dairy hack is that there was a campaign that started when, you know, posting random content to web forums around the internet, but the real target was a different website. And in fact, the real target wasn't even that website. It was another website still. So you can kind of see how these attacks move from place to place to place with different types of techniques and different types of coordination. And that's the part that is still pretty hard for most of the platforms to recognize and fully absorb. So when you see something show up on Facebook or Twitter or whatever it is, all you can do is evaluate other Twitter activity. But what if the people who were collaborating on that attack actually decided how they were going to work? They like kind of planned the attack on Reddit, or maybe they planned the attack in a private Facebook group, or, you know, that type of thing, I think, is where most of the platforms are still vulnerable. And it's something they're just, it's going to take a long time for them to figure out how they can collaborate in a way that stops this problem without undermining their business.
Right. And then what role does a company like yours play? Like, how do you measure the impact of these campaigns or investigate them as they're unfolding? And are you going to these companies and saying, hey, you got a little cultured dairy problem brewing? We're just going to, you know, I'm just going to stick with that example because it's so harmless seeming compared to all of the other examples.
Well, we do. And the nice thing is that I think most of them have been fairly receptive. So, you know, I think for them, if you could, I think the thing that sometimes is tough for people to fully, like, to really know in their bones is how large these social media platforms are. And I can appreciate a little bit because I used to work as a software engineer, and trying to imagine how anybody would engineer a system that billions of people could use and that like those billions of people could post like many billions of pieces of content or posts or photos or text or whatever. It's really a lot to manage. And so what I think a positive thing that we're finding is that when we reach out and say, hey, we're focused on a really small problem. You know, we have this is not a real customer of ours, but we'll just pretend for fun. You know, we have a customer that is a cheese manufacturer. And our customer, the cheese manufacturer, is really concerned about people repurposing their content and manipulating other users with this kind of cultured dairy spam. So, hey, Facebook, maybe you could help us out and see whether or not, you know, this is legitimate. Or, hey, Twitter, we're seeing this, you know, cultured dairy spam kind of all over the place. Maybe you could look into it. And I think so far we found that they're pretty receptive, and they're a lot more interested in working with outside groups than they used to be, just because I think everybody recognizes that it's a problem that impacts all of us, and it's really difficult to solve on your own.
So one last thing before we let you go. How big is the kind of, you know, when you talk about these cognitive hackers, it makes me wonder, is this a little bit of a new labor force? I mean, how many people are... Yeah, right. Essentially doing this work, whether they know it or not, either as state-sponsored actors or, you know, employees of Cambridge Analytica, that kind of thing, or the Internet Research Agency.
I think that's the thing that is probably the larger story almost. Like, even though the election hacking in 2016 has been a huge story, I think what it actually reveals is that the substance of this social internet that we've all come to enjoy maybe over the past decade is just full of corruption and full of manipulation. And so there are firms that are designed to almost conduct that manipulation or engage in cognitive hacking professionally, like the Internet Research Agency or the data that Cambridge Analytica provided to its customers or whatever. But there's also a lot of kind of semi-pro sort of like professional trolling almost kind of coordinated manipulation that happens. And then there's a huge like almost like a gray market for trading in this type of activity. So if you have the right amount of Bitcoin and you know who to give it to, they will publish whatever you want on whatever platform you want. And maybe it's human beings and maybe it's fake accounts and maybe it's software and maybe it's a bunch of people kind of sitting in a factory and, you know, in Indonesia or something. And, you know, it's like it's really difficult to know, but this whole ecosystem is just full of that type of activity. And like I say, some of it's professional, some of it's kind of amateurish. But what I think it really reveals is how much we've sort of overlooked these vulnerabilities for so long that they've become really deeply rooted in our entire online information ecosystem. And so it's going to take a while to sort it out and to get to the point where we're comfortable believing in the content that we're consuming online.
Here's my takeaway. Don't trust anything you see online. That's it. It's all
you know, I was talking to somebody recently
except what
who
you
said,
see from Make Me Smart. Sorry.
Right.
Anyway, go ahead.
Right. But still, go ahead and like duck, go. It just to check up on what we told you.
Yeah.
I was just talking to someone recently who said that sort of when the internet first came around, that was.
Yeah.
She felt like that was the default. And that's what, you know, you got told in college or you got told, you know. It was don't trust anything that you read on there, and everybody's trying to scam you, and you don't know who those people are on the bulletin board. They're probably totally rapists. And so she said it almost – and then we just like crossed over into complete faith.
Yep.
And it's true that it might not be the worst thing in the world to just sort of re-up those lessons about like, nope, can't trust anything.
Because human beings are idiots, right? I mean, that's just, you know – anyway. If you like the sound of John Buckley reciting Kerrygold Butterspan, by the way, we have a longer version on our official Marketplace Facebook page for your listening pleasure.
And if any of you feel compelled, and I suspect that you will, feel free to remix Mr. John Buckley. I assume that we have his express permission and share it with us. Share it. Share us the remixes. Yes. Make him a meme. Meme him up.
God. More coming up in a minute. First, though, we are going to play Jonathan's answer to the Make Me Smart question, which I will read from my little cheat sheet here on front of me because I'm on the right side of the studio today. What is something you thought you knew but then found out you were wrong about?
Something I thought I knew.
That's a really tough question.
That's a big old hunker of a question.
Gosh, that is good.
Oh, wow. I mean, that list is long and distinguished, my friend. not to be too on the point of what we've already been talking about, but I mean, I kind of came of age in the golden era of the social internet when it was at its most promising, not to, you know, reveal my age, but at a time when we thought the best ideas will just bubble to the top. Like, this is the way to achieve, you know, the most utopian form of democracy where it's just an exchange of ideas. And the more people we have and the more ideas we have, the kind of better the outcomes will be. You know, it's been a little bit of a reckoning over the past 3 or 4 years to think about, to kind of let that dream go and think in more realistic ways about how we take our offline values, you know, the way that we communicate with each other, the way that we respect each other, the way that we share ideas, the institutions that we've developed, and take those offline values and encode them in our digital life. So that digital life might not be different. It might not be utopia. In fact, it might be a lot like real life. But that's okay. I think that's actually preferable to the dystopia that we're kind of almost like flirting with right now. So it's been an interesting process, but that's definitely an area where I've had to reevaluate what I believed in and think differently about it.
That's some insight right there, yo.
I know. I love it. It sounds kind of depressing, but then it ends up sort of hopeful, which is like there is no such thing as a utopia. And once we realize that, we could just try to make a better society with the society that we have.
Totally.
Jonathan Morgan was great.
He was great.
I love everything about this episode.
Yeah.
Already in progress.
I was just going to say, it ain't done yet. So once again, the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew but found out you were wrong about? Record your answer to it on your phone. Email it to us, makemesmart@marketplace.org.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
Hi, Al Groves from Lawrenceville, Georgia.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
That's my favorite. That's my favorite.
Yeah, right? How about that one? A lot of you heard my call last week on the episode for something about a market-based solution to ethics. Karen Tibbles wrote us, and she said this. Here's a quote. I have a new consultancy business based about business ethics. The idea is based on using the principles from Jonathan. I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, even though we talked about him on the show. Haidt. Jonathan Haidt's moral foundations theory. A business can learn about how people might react negatively and learn to predict when what they do might cause controversy. It takes ethics out of the hypothetical and into something more real because real people have these issues. She did a report on how to apply this to the issue of drug prices. There's all kinds of stuff on her website. Karen Tibbles is her name. And you can look her up. I think that's interesting. I'm still not convinced you can get a straight up market-based approach to business ethics. I'm just not.
We got a bunch of tweets about this, I will say, and one person pointed out, and it was interesting because one person tweeted and said, well, the reason to have an ethical framework behind capitalism and have market-based ethics is that without it, your companies will fail, which gets to Jonathan Haidt. I mean, Jonathan Haidt also sort of points out that basic principles. So we talked about his book, by the way, just as a reminder, The Righteous Mind, yep, in one of our book club episodes. And he argues that people have these six different foundations of moral concern, that they're care, fairness, liberty, loyalty, authority, and purity. It argues that, you know, liberals only care about the first three. Conservatives care more about the last three, loyalty, authority, and purity, with sort of sprinkles of care, fairness, and liberty. But that generally conservatives may dabble in all six.
Okay, wait. Did you like study or what? Come on.
I'm yes, just we were riff prepared
on
for this
deeply philosophical issue, like it was right there on the tip of my tongue.
Well, it was such a great, it was so great. And so then when this person said that your business will fail without this, I was reminded that his book talks a lot about how part of that morality, the idea of care and fairness and yep, treating people well, is essentially evolutionary. That we evolved into that kind of society because a society that does those things ultimately works better as opposed to destroying itself. And so if you apply that to business, it actually does make sense that in the long term, your business may be damaged by the perception that you suck.
Yes, totally. If everything were sunshine and light, but business is not all sunshine and light. And so in order to have a market-based solution to this kind of thing, you have to be able to price those six things that you just reeled off like it was on the tip of your tongue, right? Which I can't even remember now. But here's the deal. We can't even price carbon to figure out how to stop the planet from blowing itself up, let alone purity, happiness, and whatever the heck it was.
Yeah, but business is people. And people and consumers are people. Customers are.
Come on.
No, I think this is totally true. But it's not some machine. Like, we know perfectly well that it's not that algorithms alone don't do the job, that, you know, that the customer ultimately matters, that if the customer gets loud enough and stops buying things. Now, yes, we are in a period where people are being profoundly disenfranchised.
Yep.
And I think it is, but I think it's a little bit of an easy trap to fall into the idea that we are disenfranchised because we are not.
So to that point of consumers speaking up for a minute here, did you see the report out from Pew that Facebook usage is up since all of that stuff happened?
I did.
I
did. I mean, you can't – the question is going to get more diffuse in the information age because harms are harder to prove and deduce.
Yes. Yes.
I think that's unquestionably
true.
Yep. When the harm is obvious, when you can say Nike is manufacturing shoes in a way that enslaves children, then it's easier to whip up consumer outcry. When the harm...
Great example. Great example.
And that's an example where consumer pressure did make some changes.
Yep.
But when the harm is diffuse, under debate, hard to figure out, then yes, things get a lot more complicated. Go. But then I just consider it my job to keep telling people...
That's exactly right.
To be better.
Yep.
Okay. Our discussion, speaking of which, actually, we talked about ethics and data science. That discussion with Professor Laura Nureen sparked even more questions, as you might imagine, about data and privacy. Ryan Scruggs from Arizona asked us a question that was essentially on a lot of people's minds, which gets to Kai's point made just now about pricing our data.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Ryan from Arizona. My question is, do we know how much each of our social media profiles are worth to their respective platforms? When someone deletes their profile, do we know how much the platform will lose in advertisement dollars for that single profile? The reason I ask is would it be worth it for the user to just pay what their profile is worth to not be advertised to? Love the show, and thanks for all that you do to make us smarter.
I have a thought, but you're the expert.
is your thought going to be like, a nihilistic bummer? Just tell me now, Kai.
No, it won't.
Lay it on me.
All right, I'll give mine, and then you give the
Facebook
right answer.
Facebook doesn't care if you live or die.
that's totally what I should have done. Capitalism doesn't care if you live or die. But sure, delete your account. No. Look, just to the specific question here about the single user, right? It's not the single user who's valuable. It's in the aggregate. So if your value to Facebook is $1.27, that's great. You pay them $1.27. They don't care about you. They care about the aggregate. That's my response.
Yes, I would have said that was true until I found out that Facebook lets you advertise to as few as 10 people.
Yeah, that's true, too.
Like, I think they had to set a limit. Anyway, I would encourage you, Ryan, and everybody else who asked this, to listen to our episode with Glenn Weil. Actually, listen to the Marketplace Tech piece with Glenn Weil. We talked about the unpaid data labor and ideas about how people might start to quantify the value of their data and how it could be a sliding scale based on how skilled you are, like how much you are contributing to, you know, the global collection of information or training AIs because you know special things. It's a super interesting conversation that I think is just getting started. I actually really do think we're going to start to try to quantify data in that way because, frankly, I'm sorry, like if companies are going to make this much money off my data, I want in on that action. How come I'm the only one not getting paid?
Totally. Yeah. One more from Laura Noreen about the cultural differences with respect to privacy. Europe is more closed off. In other words, they understand privacy, and Americans generally more open. In other words, we don't understand privacy. We didn't ask why, though, and we got a comment from the Netherlands, actually, from Amsterdam, Martin van Waveren. And he said this: the reason we think about privacy more in terms of it being a human right is because we saw what horrible things an authoritarian and fascist regime, read the Nazis, that has access to vast swaths of data can do with all of that data. In the Netherlands, we remind ourselves of that every now and then because our very efficient and modern system at that time for registering and keeping track of civilians made it oh so easy for the Nazis to purge Jewish people from the Netherlands. Of course, this time it's private parties that own the data, but I think Snowden showed that it would be naive to think that that would put the data out of government's reach. True, and also a huge bummer.
Yeah, no, that was a point that several people made, and I appreciated it because I hadn't exactly understood where that particular cultural difference came from, and now I do.
Totally true. One more thing, and on a much lighter note, Matthew Leone, he made a graph or a chart. We were talking about my mom a couple of weeks ago, maybe just last week. I don't know. It seems like a very long time ago. He made an unbelievable graph about my mother visiting and how long it takes for me to get frustrated versus feeling bad that I'm frustrated about her being there and this whole thing. Anyway, it's awesome. It's on our Facebook page. We also tweeted it out. I think it's at the Marketplace handle. Is that right? Yeah. It's at the Marketplace handle. So search at Marketplace, and you can find that. And oh, by the way, my mom's not on Twitter, so it's completely safe for us to put that up. But it's totally spot on. And I would be interested to hear from how many people out there this resonates for them, their mother's visits. I'm just saying.
It is definitely a chart that I think can be universally applied to all mother visits.
Yes.
Possibly all visits of any kind.
By anyone who's in.
Thank you, as always, for listening and continuing to listen. Tell your friends if you like what you're hearing here. Review us on Apple Podcasts. Somebody just said, "Man, you guys have great reviews on Apple Podcasts," and that made my day. So keep them coming. Keep them coming. We appreciate it. See you next. See you Friday.
We're going to Thursday drive time. We're going to try to get it out GDPR Thursday drive time. All the producers are going, I don't know. They're making a little shruggy thing. Make Me Smart is produced by Chris Froland and Sharon Morris and senior producer Eve Tro. This week's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. Our theme music is composed by Ben Talladay. I get that wrong every time. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
They wrote it.
Where has he been, by the way?
This show really does get produced in real time, doesn't it? The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves, and hopefully the senior vice president and general manager is not listening today. Her name is Deborah Clark.
It's entirely possible we're wrong about all that behind-the-scenes stuff. I'm always like, oh, yeah, it's really possible to hear that stuff. And maybe we're wrong.
Second show could come out anytime. I don't know. Anything could happen, you guys.
It's pandemonium. Chaos.
Dogs and cats living together.
A crisis of biblical proportions. That's a good movie. I thought it was cats and dogs living together. Dogs and cats?
What did I say? Dogs and cats?
Yeah, you said dogs and cats.
It's probably cats and dogs. We're going to get an email. I know. Guarantee that.
All right.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.